shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians called to a higher level of understanding will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Good evening. This is Brother Mike of Kingdom Identity Ministries welcoming you to another one of our first of the month Kingdom Concepts programs. We're being heard tonight over WWCR 4.840 megahertz and 5.890 megahertz shortwave, and also radio station WBZQ 7.490 megahertz. Ordinarily, we have callers, but due to the schedule of our guests, we won't be taking callers tonight. However, we will next month in next month's program. We should have a most interesting program tonight. Our guest is an historian, an author, lecturer, current affairs analysis, and director of the Institute of Historical Review. I'd like to welcome to the broadcast Mark Weber.
Thank you very much for having me, Mike. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me. And I appreciate also your taking into account my schedule that wouldn't permit me to be on your regular live program.
Well, I'm sure you have much to say. You're a speaker, and I've heard some of your talks, and we can more than fill the hour. You are a historian, as I noted a moment ago, and America is following the same pattern as some other countries in history. What's your opinion of the way we're going, and including the recent results of the election that took place?
Yes, it's true. Many people, of course, have drawn parallels between what's happening in the United States today and the Roman Empire or the British Empire, other empires in the past that have become multicultural, large, expansive entities and then have fallen apart. And America is carrying on in many ways parallels what those societies did. And there's another aspect, though, of American society today, though, that makes it even worse in some ways than what happened to the Roman Empire or the Russian Empire and some of the other empires, and that is that America operates according to a kind of ideology in a way that the Roman Empire did not. The ideology of America is what I call individualistic egalitarianism, an ideology that says the United States is or should be striving for and toward a specific kind of society. And the gap and the contrast, I think, between the ideology that we say we're trying to live up to on the one hand and the reality of life and of history and society on the other, I think is becoming more and more obvious. And one good example of that, I think, and everybody's conscious of it today, is the results of this Ferguson, Missouri case. America, ideologically, is on the path dedicated to trying to create a kind of artificial equality in society and among different groups. And the effort to try to create this equality is doomed. It's not going to happen because it's based upon false premises about life and about society. But we push ahead with that because it's based on an ideology, an outlook that most Americans, anyway, have accepted. And it's hammered away in our media and our schools and so forth. And that's a particularly dangerous thing that makes the decline of America even more dramatic, I think, and even faster than what happened with the Roman Empire and some of the other empires in history.
I know that their violent nature not only takes place in the United States, but in South Africa and other countries. It's just part of their genetics. However, the police, it appeared to be justified in the case of Missouri there, but Ferguson, Missouri. But quite often, the police in this country have become brutal to our own race. They taser old ladies and break into homes and shoot people unjustly and so on. So we are seeing a police state among our own people.
Yes, America is becoming a more militarized, a more top-heavy society in which, and part of the reason for that, I think, is that the people who go into police work are increasingly, you might say, hard-edged men, people who might be more tolerant or more understanding or more like other people than was the case in the past. There's a real increasing stratification in American life, and we see this kind of coarsening of American life. I don't know how old you are, but almost anyone who's over the age of 50 or 60 remembers that the United States was a lot more easygoing country than it has become in recent years. There's just far more hostility, less civility, less politeness there than there was when I was young. And of course, older than you or I remember when America was a much more, I think, civil and easygoing country than it's become in the last years. And that's reflected also not only in day-to-day life, but also, as you point out, in our police, in our military, and in other aspects of American life.
We were taught that the policeman was your friend when I was growing up, and that was pretty much true. And today they've become brutal, and I think a lot of it is because of the military. They put us into unjust wars, and a lot of the military men come out and become policemen, and they continue to just do as they're told by certain politicians and become militarized, as you say.
We see, of course, a tremendous, I would say, coarsening and brutalization you might see in our popular culture. There's just far more hostility, far more contentiousness, far more just lack of civility in cultural life in America, in our motion pictures, in our music, and so forth. And that has also, I think, been a factor in contributing to the, you might say, coarsening and the hostility, the combativeness of American life.
Well, unfortunately, the right, as it's called, the Republican Party, has become the warmongering party more so than the left. So the recent election, Ron Paul speculated, will be worse on our foreign policy than what we've got now.
I think a lot of people might take issue with you about that because the Obama administration, and of course many Democratic administrations in the past, have been every bit as quick to go to war as many Republican presidents. If there's one thing that the American public expected from the Obama administration, is that it would not be as involved in war as it's proven to be. Remember, Obama was given the Nobel Peace Prize, perhaps the world's highest award, not for anything he had actually done, but based on the expectation that his policies would be more peaceful, more restrained than that of George W. Bush. And if there's any real huge level of area of big disappointment, not only in the United States, but even especially around the world, it's with regard to foreign policy. I remember 3 years ago, Obama declared and pontificated that the government of Syria, the president of Syria, had to go, and he was going to go. And he said it's not a matter of weeks, it's a matter of days. And the United States began giving military assistance to people that were trying to overthrow the government of Syria. And the United States is now bombing parts of Syria to fight, the people who are trying to overthrow Assad because there's so much confusion in American foreign policy. But very, very few people expected anything like that from Obama when he became president some 6 years ago. But that's just one example. Remember, the biggest wars that America has been involved in, the First and Second World Wars, were both presided over by Democrat presidents, not by Republican presidents. Although I agree with you that McCain, I think, would have been a catastrophe for the United States as a president, especially in foreign affairs.
Well, I'm basically saying that there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two parties.
I mean, I thought you were sort of suggesting the Republicans would be worse. Maybe they would, but the Democrats are much better. And that, you know, that, Mike, that really, I think, just underscores something that's really important to emphasize. And that's how across the board, the public, whether they call themselves liberal or conservative, young or old, are very cynical, very distrustful of our political system, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans. Polls show unprecedented, I mean, just historically unparalleled levels of distrust and cynicism by people toward our politicians, Congress, the media. This level of distrust, this level of unhappiness and cynicism about our political has never been had this level in American history, and you'll see this as a problem across the Western world. That alone is a real reason why America is in real trouble. When the public has this high a level of distrust of our political leaders, that's a really dangerous thing for any society. No society can function well, especially in times of crisis, I mean real crisis, if the public just doesn't have a minimal level of confidence and trust in our leaders, and that's not happened. I mean, many people have made the point that if the United States was involved in a war in which our leaders thought was necessary to start drafting people again, it would be a catastrophe. I don't know if you remember, but there was such tremendous opposition during the Vietnam War that many Americans just tore up their draft cards, they refused, they fled to Canada, they wouldn't cooperate, and today, if the government tried to draft people, I think it would be certainly far more opposition, far more resistance than there was even during the Vietnam War. And that's an expression of just how the levels of distrust and disregard for authority and trust in our government, things have increased, have gone over the last 10, 15 years.
Well, I'd agree with you as far as the distrust, but the people as a whole don't seem to be waking up to, for instance, the Jewish financial powers behind both the political parties and the media and our money system itself, as far as that goes.
That's true. Yes, that's right. It hasn't really translated into any coherent, organized opposition, and I think there's a real good reason for that. Unlike Europe or unlike England, France, or other countries that have especially the continental European countries and many other nations, which have gone through many different systems of government, different flags, different currencies. America has had the same flag in place, the same constitution, at least in name, in place for more than two centuries, the same currency, the same basic, at least on the surface, the same basic form of government. And that's why Americans have a hard time envisioning, I think, anything really drastically different than some variant of what we have. The American people, American history doesn't have the same radical changes. We haven't undergone the kind of real radical changes that many other countries have undergone. In the past 100 years or 200 years, France has had different kinds of governments. It's been occupied. It's lost wars. It's been bombed. Americans have not undergone that kind of really radical shifting that many other countries have. I mean, in our own lifetimes, Russia has, in the last 100 years, of course, the Bolsheviks took over in 1917 in Russia and imposed this drastically different form of society. There were several years of civil war, followed by the brutal Stalinist period. Then came the Second World War. Large parts of the country were, of course, occupied. Huge loss of life. And then the whole Soviet thing collapsed in the late 1980s and early 1990s. A different flag. Different. Everything's quite different. They lost it. I mean, that's something Americans have not undergone. And so I think the vast majority of Americans are unhappy, but they don't know, they cannot envision a real alternative. When I talk with Americans about where things should go and what should be done and so forth, the people I talk to overwhelmingly see things from a very America-centric point of view. What I mean by that is their historical outlook, their sense of the past, the present, the future is very much focused on the experiences of the United States. They don't draw lessons from other countries. They can't imagine the United States having completely different flags or completely different forms of different constitution. In fact, the vast majority of white Americans, conservative Americans, Republicans, white Americans, they want to try to hold on as much as they can to the constitution, the flag, or what they see as what's left of America. That's why they can't really envision some radical alternative to the present. And that's one of the reasons why, even though there's a lot of unhappiness with what's going on in the country, and this is across the board, there's no leadership or articulation of how to change that. I don't know if you listen. I mean, the most popular radio show in America is Rush Limbaugh. And I have to confess, I do listen to it sometimes in the morning when I'm coming into the office. And Rush Limbaugh gives this, I think, completely unrealistic and deceitful even view of America. He seems to think, and he tells his listeners, that if America just sort of returns to the way we were in 1960 or under Ronald Reagan or something, everything would be much better. I don't know if his listeners even really believe it exactly, but this is what he says, because it's very hard for somebody like Rush Limbaugh and for the most of his listeners and for most Americans to envision anything other than sort of return to a Ronald Reagan or some dialing back the clock to John F. Kennedy, something like that.
And they don't realize the oppression that took place under those regimes. It just seemed to go by them.
It's very difficult to imagine things different, because up until the 80s or the 70s, life was pretty good in America. I mean, from the end of World War II up until about 1980, Americans experienced a period of just unparalleled growth and prosperity. There's some specific historical reasons why that was, but most Americans, especially white Americans, think that that period of prosperity was because we're great, we're a good people, we have a good form of government, and so they can't very well imagine throwing that all aside to go off into something that they don't they can't imagine. Remember, the history of America up until last 30, 40 years or so has been generally a very steadily more prosperous one. That's why it's very hard for Americans to understand or to examine, but where did it go wrong and why did it go wrong? But I think you raising these points, I think, is some of the most important issues that need to be raised by thinking Americans. What went wrong and why? What really happened? Because without an understanding of what went wrong and why, we can't very well deal in any constructive way with the grave problems that we have today in our society.
And a lot of the economic power that we have is false, because our dollar is worth only pennies from what it was, say, 100 years ago.
Right, that's true. But that process has been going on for a long time. And during most of that period, America was still not only prosperous, but getting more prosperous. I mean, prosperity increased immensely from World War II up until the 1980s, essentially. But since the 80s, real income for the vast majority of Americans has stayed stagnant or has gone down. But up until that time, things were getting better. So when people bring up that very point that you're making, they'll say, well, that may be, but life was getting better and better in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and for much of the 70s.
Well, they also tout Lincoln as being one of our best presidents, and yet he had a lot of regulations, martial law and so on, that people don't realize.
That's true. But again, it's hard to think that he's all that bad for most people, because, after all, America continued to expand at a rapid clip during and after the Lincoln presidency. You know, during the Civil War, even though the North was fighting to subdue the South during the Civil War, economically, the United States continued to prosper in the North. The Transatlantic Railroad was being undergone. There was a building going on. I mean, big construction and economic boom was taking place in the northern states during the Civil War. And so the points, when people make the kind of points you're making, and they're important points, nonetheless, real prosperity, I mean, people's standard of living increased during those years.
Of course, a lot of people don't even think anymore. Our early founding fathers looked at different issues from different viewpoints. But today, our people are dumbed down in the public schools, and they have no knowledge of history or economic system or what's being done to them. If they are so-called patriots, they often just give a blind USA, USA, you know, just an unthinking chant or something like that. And it's really right. disappointing.
That's very true. That's very true. Well, of course, that gets into a sort of tragedy of America. The founding fathers, the people who wrote the Declaration of Independence, who made the Constitution of the United States, and I mean by that both constitutions, both the Articles of Confederation and the present Constitution, did not believe, they were very distrustful of mass democracy. They did not believe that every individual in the country should have the same amount of political power, that is one vote, which is the theory of modern democracy. They believe that some people, only some people are and should be entrusted with political power. And in fact, it's impossible today to see how something like the Constitution of the United States could be made. The original Constitution, or the Constitution we have now, was made in secret. It wasn't hammered out in public. Every one of the delegates, the 55 men who were involved in putting it together, pledged beforehand not to discuss it with anyone outside of the hall where they worked it out. And they were a select group of men. They were not the mass of people. And that's another problem, because in a mass democratic society, not only political life, but the cultural life is dumbed down. It's brought down to a low denominator. And in America today, political discourse is far more slipshod, superficial, reduced to slogans. And we see the effects of that over and over. Of our elections are based in large measure for many people on how a candidate, how clever he is, how he looks. Very, very superficial factors are involved.
Popularity contest, same thing.
Well, I don't know if it's worth reading. For example, the Lincoln Douglas debates in 1858. Stephen Douglas and Abraham Lincoln were candidates for Senate in Illinois, and in those days, these debates required a level of attention and a level of awareness that the public today in America would just not put up with. The format of the Lincoln-Douglas debates took place over a three-hour period. Each candidate spoke for a whole hour, then the other spoke for an hour, and then there was a rebuttal for half an hour, and then another half hour. 3 hours! And if you read the text of the Lincoln-Douglas debate, the arguments are well-organized, complex arguments that require the public in those days coming large distances by foot or on horse or in buggy to hear candidates present a lengthy, involved argumentation that today would be unthinkable. The attention span of the American public has shrunk down to just minutes, if that much, in a way that you could not imagine the public listening to a very well thought out but also involved and complex presentation by a man like Abraham Lincoln or Stephen Douglas today.
We're not allowed to address certain subjects in this country from an intelligence standpoint with the facts, such as the truth about 9/11. Over in Europe especially, they can't discuss the so-called Holocaust. So we are limited in the subjects we can even address and make people aware of what's going on.
Right. Well, I go back again to the power of what's emerged in the United States of an ideology. That is a worldview, a prevailing way of looking at things that suppresses and cuts out any open discussion. I mean, one of the most obvious examples, or important example, important manifestations of that, is this ideological fixation on equality. This idea, which is enshrined in our laws and in our educational system, that human beings are all born equally able, and that the only reason that some people don't do better than others is because their opportunities or the socialization or their environment is not fair, is not as good as it ought to be. This is foolishness. This is completely wrong. And any society trying to make policy on the basis of such views is it's doomed. It can't work. Now, more specifically, in 2002, the U.S. Congress overwhelmingly passed what was called the No Child Left Behind Act, and it was pushed by President George Bush. The No Child Left Behind Act is based on the notion that every kid in school ought to do equally well if he just has the right education, the right socialization, the right background. But this is madness. It, of course, the No Child Left Behind Act has been gutted and abandoned because it's based on a false premise about life. And that's one of the, I think, huge problems in the United States is this ideological straitjacket that America is forced to put on or does put on, which makes realistic views about life and about the world impossible because we have this ideology that we're living up to.
Well, there's certainly differences between people, even within our own race, but there are greater differences between our race and the other races, and this has been understood throughout history, physical, mental, and spiritual differences.
Right. I mean, life teaches every intelligent, discerning person that human beings are not born with equal abilities. Not everybody is going to be a great basketball player. Not everybody is going to be a nuclear physicist. Not everybody is going to be all sorts of things. But the American educational system and American political life is based upon this utopian, this delusional view about human beings. Even apart from race, it's true within families, within everything, within life. And life teaches anybody who lives long enough, he understands that. But the ideology that prevails in America says that you're not supposed to take that into account. You're supposed to ignore that, and instead, we're supposed to be striving for this world based upon false premises about life and history. But that's not only true in our domestic policy, it's true in our foreign policy as well. America accepts, and even conservatives accept, this idea that history is moving in a certain direction. It's heading toward ever greater freedom and equality. And even conservatives accept this view. And this means that the United States today pushes for foreign policy that tries to make over other countries into a kind of image of the United States. You know that the Obama administration says that pushing for what he calls gay rights is a feature of American foreign policy around the world, everywhere in the world. I mean, not only is it utopian, but it's immensely arrogant for the United States or for any country to press something like that. But that's part of American foreign policy. And this utopian, this unrealistic, this view of America and its place in the world has been a feature, an important aspect of American policy for a long time, certainly at least a century, if not more.
I know that we have a distorted view of, for instance, World War II that's being taught to our people. And
right.
The right uses everything about the Third Reich or Hitler or something as a boogeyman. And I'm not saying that there weren't features that I couldn't agree with, but as a whole, it's just a distortion. And I think it hurts overall if we take an unrealistic view of what took place.
Right. Well, I would say even more than that, and you'll find this problem especially true of those who call themselves conservative, but it's true of liberals as well. They see problems in the world not in terms of competing interests and of clashes of nations or of cultures or races or religions, but they see it in terms of a clash between good and evil. This is very, very pronounced in the United States, this notion that if there's problems somewhere in the world, it's because a bad guy is doing it. And this is a very childish, simplistic view of how the world works, but it's a big feature of America, the American outlook. And it's very, very characteristic of American foreign policy over the past century or so. The demonization of whatever country or power that the United States is having a rivalry or a problem with at the time. And in fact, it's so ludicrous, so ridiculous, that the good guy of one year can become the bad guy of a little bit later. And we've seen this throughout the 20th century.
I think it's sometimes our team versus your team. It's just a football match or something.
Right, right. No, I think that's a very, you put your finger, I think, on a very important and dangerous aspect of American foreign policy. That is, that looks at wars not in the way that other countries do, but as a kind of football match. That win or lose, the home team comes back home and life goes on. One thing I learned, and this is was an important feature of my education and my upbringing, was living overseas and realizing that war for people in France or Germany or Poland or Japan or China is something very different than it is for Americans. War means destruction, bombing, famine, huge suffering and misery and destruction. America went through the First and Second World War not only with no bombs falling, with no real problems, but the economy boomed during those times. Except for the people who were actually getting shot or wounded overseas, World War I and World War II was good for America. And it expanded our power, the economy expanded, and people look at war very differently, or tend to look at war very differently in the United States than how people look at war overseas. The only exception to that in our history, in modern history, was the Civil War, which of course was an enormously destructive thing for the South. But except for that, the Americans have not experienced war in anything like the horrific way that many other countries have. That's why we have somebody like John McCain or even George Bush or so forth. They talk very, very loosely about going to war because they have this notion, which is fortified by experience, that whatever happens, it's not going to really affect us in any direct, really horrible way, in the way that warfare has affected the peoples actually in place in Vietnam or Japan or Germany or Poland or Russia or so forth.
I know, as I mentioned earlier, you recently returned from Europe, but you've also been at least in Iran, perhaps the rest of the Middle East. Would you like to comment on the popular mass opinion of the Middle East foreign policy in general and what's really taking place in both Palestine and Iran and so on in the Middle East?
Well, the most obvious thing to stress about U.S. policy in the Middle East is that, as even the U.S. ambassador to Israel, a man named Daniel Shapiro, said a couple of years ago, the central criteria, the central feature of American foreign policy in the Middle East is based on what's good for Israel. Not what's best for America, but what's best for Israel. This completely skews U.S. policy in the Middle East, and it's a reason why the United States is the only country that time and again has this blank check support for Israel in a way that no other country does. This isn't because our policy is wiser or more insightful than that of other countries. It's because the organized Jewish community in America has tremendous power, and the organized Jewish community in America insists that our politicians carry out policies that are going to be good for Israel, good for a country that they identify with. This is tremendously dangerous because it means that our political leaders put their it's an expression of the fact that our political leaders put what's good for their careers ahead of what's good for America and the world. And this is especially, most of all, true, of course, with regard to the Middle East. And it makes Israel's enemies America's enemies, with the huge amount of propaganda that the American public is subject to. But, you know, over the past 10, 15 years, repeatedly in the United Nations, there are these lopsided votes in which the United States and Israel and maybe the Marshall Islands or a couple of other countries are on one side, and the entire rest of the world is on the other side. That's not because people in Australia or Finland are stupid or bigoted or backward. It's because the United States is a country in which the organized Jewish community has this huge grip, this tight grip on our political life, in our cultural life, and so forth. Anyway, that skews our entire policy in the Middle East. But there's even more problems, of course, or a different kind of problem with regard to U.S. Foreign policy in general. But that's the most, I think, the thing that needs to be stressed above all with regard to U.S. policy in the Middle East. And we see a manifestation of it right now, and of course, in Syria, but the dispute with Iran, and of course, the invasion of Iraq.
What's disappointing is that people that I generally have a little bit more respect for, like Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, they're spouting the same line.
Right. Well, I've been, of course, disappointed by Rand Paul. I do respect political figures if they are principled, if they're honest, at least. I may disagree with them about some things, but I do think that Ron Paul and Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader were at least principled men, even if I disagree with them on this or that issue. But Rand Paul seems to be a man who does not have the same level of devotion to principle, of honesty, or principle, you, however you want to put it, as his father. But in any case, I mention those three only because they're so exceptional, because with so few exceptions, the vast majority of American politicians don't have principle. They will do what's good for their careers above all else.
We may be facing some laws like they have in Europe, where we can't speak on certain subjects because there would be penalties, even though we have a tradition of freedom of speech in this country. Such
yeah.
as I mentioned earlier, they can't speak on the so-called Holocaust. And yet Europe has certain nationalist political parties that are rising over there. And
right.
I know that you were banned from speaking at a conference in Hungary, and yet Hungary has one of the largest nationalist political parties. Could you give us a picture of just what's taking place in Europe?
Well, you're talking about this so-called Future of Europe conference in early October. It was being organized by something called the National Policy Institute in the United States, and just shortly before it was to take place, Hungarian authorities banned it. Now, they banned it because even the nationalist or more or less nationalist party in Hungary, the Jobbik Party, had no advantage in affiliating itself with this organization. But more than that, the Hungarian press portrayed the people at this conference and the organizer of it as a beefy, skinhead, tattoo-wearing, ignoramus neo-Nazi types or bikers or something. They portrayed this in a very, very untruthful and deceitful way. And so the Hungarian authorities banned it also, I think, because they were under pressure from outside forces to ban it as well. Now, we don't know the whole story on that, but that's my suspicion for various reasons I could go into. But in any case, it's true that the Hungarian ruling party, the Fidesz party, is more, you might say, nationalist or more patriotic, you might say, than American. But Hungary is not a strong country. It's a country of only 10 million people, and it's subject to pressure in a way that France or Germany or Italy or Britain is not. And so it was the easiest thing was for the Hungarian authorities simply to ban the event. Now, having said that, it was banned, but the one of the speakers, Jared Taylor, was able to, along with some other people, organize a kind of makeshift substitute dinner. But it wasn't really a full conference, and a couple of organizers of the original conference, Richard Spencer and Bill Regnery, were banned and detained and refused entry into the country, or were arrested and sent out of the country. So that's why the thing fell through. But the parties that are have been rising in France, in Britain, in Hungary, in Denmark, and Sweden. The anti-establishment parties, often,
I believe also Greece,
and Greece as well. Yes, right. In some cases, their actual policies and programs are a bit vague, but they reflect across the continent of Europe a phenomenon that's similar to the United States. That is tremendous unhappiness with the system. There's a a real strong feeling all across Europe that Europe is dying. It's being, not only is the birth rate below replacement level, but the political leaders who have been in power have permitted or even encouraged large-scale third world immigration into Europe, which is means the displacement and the end of Europe. Well, London is now a city with a majority non-British population. Paris is moving very quickly toward that as well. And the same process that we've seen take place here in this country is taking place in Europe, and for very similar reasons. That is, Europe is dedicated to an ideology of egalitarianism, individualism, in which nation, culture, religion, national cohesion are supposedly all bad things. They're unimportant things. And the result is, by pushing the policies based on this ideology, it means the end of Europe. To put it another way, the Americanization of Europe means the death of Europe, means the end of Europe. And all across Europe, there's a polls show tremendous unhappiness with the system. And this dissatisfaction, this unhappiness is reflected in May in the vote in Britain for the so-called UKIP, the United Kingdom Independence Party, which is an anti-EU party. It's really a protest party. It's unclear what this party would actually do if it came to power, but it was very telling that in the May European parliamentary elections, UKIP came in first. And in France, the National Front Party got more support than any other party in France. And similar things are happening in other countries. But all of this is just an astonishing development because for many, many years, since the end of the Second World War, political scene in European countries was dominated by establishment parties, usually one more or less centrist so-called conservative party, and on the other hand, a kind of liberal leftist party. In Britain, it would be the conservatives and the Labour Party. In France, the Gaullists and the socialists, and so forth. In Germany, the social democrats on the one hand, and then the Christian democrats. But that's being upset now all across Europe because there's tremendous unhappiness with the system. And it's more than just unhappiness with the stagnant economic system. It's a sense that the politicians don't really care about the people or the future of their country. The parties that traditionally are supposed to represent the working class in France or in Britain or Germany and so forth show that they have utterly betrayed their own base of support by encouraging large-scale third world immigration of unskilled and only poorly skilled labor, which destroys and hurts the very basis of support of these so-called labor parties or leftist and social democratic parties. But anyway, that's a phenomenon you see all across Europe. Europe has a high unemployment rate except for Germany, but more importantly, there's no realistic sense of how this is all going to get better. The political leaders in Europe, like those in America, offer no realistic vision of how anything's going to really get better. Instead, they just mouth these slogans about diversity and prosperity and equality and so forth, and people in Europe and in the United States believe them less and less as time goes on.
Well, I think virtually everything you said about the situation there in Europe could be applied to America. The Republican Party and the Democrat Party and the dissatisfaction, and certainly the flooding of this nation by aliens from Mexico and other places. And yet it hasn't translated into a national party in this country that has attracted any significant following.
Right. This is a point I made. I gave a talk in London to a meeting organized by something called the London Forum, and I've spoken also here in the United States and Northern Virginia and also here in California on the European situation just recently. But the one of the most striking things is the parallels, the similarities between the crisis of the West, not only in Europe but also in the United States. But the reason why this has not expressed itself in the United States in any important alternative party, unlike in France or in Italy or in some other countries, there's two basic reasons for that. First, there's a structural reason. That is, America has a winner-take-all political system. That gives a huge advantage to a two-party system. It makes it very difficult in America to have a third party win, because it's got to win an outright majority, or at least a plurality, in any given area. If a political movement is getting only 20% of the vote, it won't capture enough support to actually get people in office, and so it's not represented. Britain has the same thing, and so the UKIP party has done very well in the European parliamentary elections, which are based on proportional representation, but they aren't represented or barely represented in regular politics, because Britain, like the United States, has this winner-take-all, or in Britain they call it first-past-the-gate system. That's one reason. The second reason why there's not been the rise of a real alternative party here in America is because it takes tremendous gutsiness to stand up and to say things that need to be said in this country, because you'll be attacked as a racist or a neo-Nazi or anti-Semite. You'll be called all sorts of names here in this country. The media goes along with this, and many Americans go along with it. To put it another way, it's very difficult for Americans to envision and support anything other than some variation, some variant, some form of the Republican and Democratic Party, because that would mean, any real alternative means saying, in effect, that we've been on the wrong track in America for many, many years. That's very difficult for Americans to accept or understand, I think.
Of course, part of that's because of who controls the news media and who controls the public school system.
Right. Well, Americans have a kind of naive view that the way things are in America is the way they are supposed to be. That, if somebody takes control of the media, well, that's the way, that's our system, and we allow that, and that's the way it can be. Americans don't have a strong sense of identity of who we are in the way that Europeans do. And so they are not able, it's much more difficult in America to mobilize or to be active on any basis here in this country, because there's not a coherent basis for most Americans to act on. To put it more, a little more plainly, Americans have a hard time saying what their identity is. Very few Americans are reluctant to say, well, my identity is European American. They'll say, I'm American. But what is an American? Well, that's a very vague thing. It's anybody who's here and who says, well, I believe in America, I guess. But that's not much of a basis for activism and making and sacrifice. Anyway, I guess my point is that America has a big problem of identity, and a big problem of answering this basic question, who we are. And because if people doesn't have a strong sense of who we are, then they have a very strong, great difficulty then in sort of acting in an organized, coherent way.
Well, even in places where they have a stronger identity, such as Great Britain, they're being sold out by their leaders.
That's true, too. That's true.
Both the left and the right.
That's very true. That's true. But the problem's even greater here in this country. After all, at the end of the Second World War, the United States and the Soviet Union were the dominant powers in the world, and they imposed not only their military and financial and economic power on other countries, they also imposed their ideology. The ideology that Western Europeans accept today is the ideology that was basically imposed by the United States at the end of the Second World War. And so it's almost inevitable then, given that Europe is going to be more and more like the United States.
Well, our founding fathers denounced democracy as one of the worst forms of government, and that's what's being pushed. And as you said, the people of the masses, who are not equal in ability to some of our great leaders of the past, are having an equal say.
Well, you're putting your finger, Mike, on why anybody who makes these kinds of points is going to have a hard time getting elected to anything in American life. Americans don't want to hear that. They want to hear, most Americans want to hear an easy answer to our problems. I've compared it to a man who comes into the doctor's office who's 40 years old and he's hard of breath. He's tired. He looks bad. And he comes into the doctor's office and he says, "Doc, I want you to make me the way I was when I was 19. And the doctor gives him a physical exam and he checks him out and he says, "Well, you got to start exercising. You got to lose weight. You got to stop polishing off that six pack of beer every night. You got to stop eating those double cheeseburgers and you've got to change your attitude and your way of life." And the answer of the 40-year-old guy to his doctor is, "I don't want to hear all that. I want you to give me a pill the way I, and make me the way I was when I was 19. Now, that's a little bit like what America is today. A lot of people, they want things, they want an easy way to be the way we used to be. And they don't want to really change. They think that there's some easy answer out there, some way out of all of this, without taking very, very difficult measures that are going to be necessary if America is to, if Americans are to have a real future in the years to come.
That's true.
It's another comparison I make sometimes is with an alcoholic. Alcoholics tell themselves they don't really have a problem. They justify what they're doing. They justify their illness. And alcoholics don't change until finally they hit bottom. Now, for each person, that's a different thing. For some alcoholics, it's when they lose their job and they lose their house and their wife leaves. For others, it's when they're trying to get food out of dumpsters. For others, it can be a different point. But at some point, they say, "Okay, I've got to change," because they hit bottom in some way. America hasn't hit bottom. And so we tell ourselves there's nothing fundamentally wrong with America. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with the way we've been doing things. So they're in denial, really, about how serious the problem is. They're in denial. Americans are in denial. This is a society in denial about life and about some very basic fundamental things.
Well, we need to change the hearts of the people, and part of that's done through education. I know both you and we have books and videos and so on, but the people in large quantities don't even want to listen. They would rather listen to the trivial pursuits that they're going about in life. Do you have an answer that may improve the situation?
Well, I you're right. I think that given the way things are, the only realistic work that's productive in our time, the only effort that's really realistic and productive right now is educational work. The system is so hostile to not only what we believe, but to just, I think, reality, that it's got to break down. It's got to hit bottom, so to speak. And unless and until that happens, the vast majority of people are not going to want to hear what we say, because what we offer, what we're suggesting, it means pain. It means some real difficulty. But that means then that our educational work must be directed, therefore, not at the mass of people, but at the minority, because in every society, it's only a minority that is really discerning, that has the wit, the heart, the intelligence, the soul to care about these things and to understand them. In other words, we have to aim our work above all, I think, at younger people who must and will be, I think, and leaders in the future if we're to have a future.
Putting it biblically, the elect, those who have eyes to see and ears to hear, which is a small remnant.
Well, I was just going to make your point that, yeah, in all history, the percentage of people who really care about the future beyond their own lives, who care about the world beyond themselves and their immediate family and friends, is always a very small one. But history is made by people like that. And that's who we, I think, have to be aim our work at. Because if we have leaders in the future who have the same unrealistic view of the world that the leaders we have now, there'll be no real improvement. Things will just continue on. But things are rapidly shifting all over the world and here in the United States. This is a very, very dramatic time we're living in. These are very, very big changes that are taking place, and they're going to speed up, I think, in the years ahead. There was a kind of continuity of American life from during the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and up until the 80s. But in recent years, there's been some big changes. The end of the Soviet Union, the third worldization of America, the majority of the population of the most populous state, California, is now non-white. The unprecedented levels of distrust of our system, of our politicians and our Congress and so forth. All of these are big, big things, big factors that are going to have real consequences in the years to come.
I was going to say, why don't you give our listeners some information about the Institute for Historical Review and give some contact information so they can contact you for the material you carry?
Thank you, Mike. Yes, I urge your listeners to check out our website, Institute for Historical Review, and the URL is ihr.org. And you'll find a tremendous amount of information about current affairs, about history, about the world, and so forth. Use the search feature, and if you're interested, sign up for the roundups, the bulletins that we put out several times a week that we compile and send out about things that are going on in the world today and with perspective on things going on from a historical point of view. So I urge people to check that out, and if you like what you see, help support us or let other people know about what we're doing.
Well, we're near the end of the broadcast. Would you like to make some concluding points?
Well, I want to express my gratitude for what you're doing, because I think we should be very grateful and appreciative and supportive of what anyone is doing that is basically positive, that is educating people about the problems, the real problems that we face from a deeper point of view. And so I just want to express my appreciation for what you're doing and for having me on as your guest today.
Well, I certainly appreciate what you're doing and appreciate you coming on as a guest today. We hope that our listeners will contact you and that the truth will get out. So I'd like to thank you once again for being our guest, and our closing announcement and our contact information will be given now.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.